Welcome to the 61st episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chatz.
And as the Birmingham Bears win the T20 Blast, welcome to the podcast that is not planning a rebrand.
This is, of course, the ludicrous rebranding, indeed, that the Warwickshire Bears have undergone with their T20 side to become the Birmingham Bears. In this episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about 2020 cricket. We're going to be talking about some of the international cricket going on at the moment. Andy's going to be taking us through a 37-year feud, and we're going to be reviewing Miles Jupp's excellent book, Fibber in the Heat. Now, Andy, what has caught your attention over the last couple of weeks since we last recorded?
I was at Lord's on Friday to see the visiting India team try to recover from the obviously rather miserable finale to the Test series with a warm-up game at versus Middlesex. Fantastic atmosphere at the ground, the fans queuing round the block, which you don't really expect for a warm-up game nowadays. And the incredible passion of the Indian fans there meant that this casual game actually had something of the IPL about it. I mean, it was really, really loud. What was interesting is that we sometimes talk about this rather infamous Norman Tebbit test. You know, who do you support as a second generation immigrant? Do you support your home country, whether that be India, Pakistan, or do you support your new country, your adopted country, England? What was interesting is that many of the Indian fans present completely transcended that test. They roared on the Indian players, but they also went mad for some of the Middlesex players, Stephen Finn, and perhaps more oddly, Ollie Rayner, the spinner. It was also quite interesting to note that Dhoni, for all the flack he's taken in the press, the response he got from the Indian fans was something that I've just never seen on a cricket field. I mean, it was true rock star adulation. Absolutely extraordinary.
Now, in terms of kind of the reception of cricketers on cricket pitches recently, what better story can there be? Sorry, not wanting to trump your story, but anyway, what better story can there be than the return of Freddie Flintoff to the Lancashire side for one last hurrah in the finals of the 2020s yesterday? Often when players come back out of retirement, you know, they're ailing, they're aged, they're a shadow of their former selves, and it's all a kind of source of embarrassment, and no one wins, really. But actually, as far as I can tell, not having seen the match, but having... is that the only downside of this whole thing was actually simply that Lancashire didn't win. And I think there's this kind of wonderful thing with someone like Flintoff, that he comes back and he is so much now a part of folklore, that even though he has over the last few years spent much of his career kind of feeding off the tackier parts of the media, and even though he didn't have the greatest performance when he played yesterday, although he did do well, taking a wicket and scoring 20 handy runs, yet still there's this real connection that he has with fans. And I think that's something really to be celebrated. And I just wondered, when I was reading about this, what would have happened if Peterson came back from, you know, from retirement, from being out of the England side, being out of the county side, and came back and played a game. He'd have to make an absolutely stellar performance to win over the crowd. But I think it's wonderful that someone like Flintoff still has that rapport with fans.
I think the contrast's a really interesting one. I mean, I think you make the point, so many comebacks go wrong because the player just doesn't have it anymore and they sort of taint their legend. And Flintoff certainly didn't do that. He seems to have got his place back in the Lancashire team on merit. And quite extraordinary. I mean, that 20 off 8 balls he hit yesterday, he so nearly did get Lancashire home. I'm just kind of staggered by the fact that his body's still up for it, given what seemed to be the case a few years ago. He seemed to be, you know, an absolute, you know, no fault of his own. His body seemed to be falling apart. But
this is the joy of 2020 cricket, I suppose, is that people can come back and, you know, he bowls two overs or whatever. I think it was two overs he bowled.
He bowled just 12 balls, yeah.
He only has to bat for... So he bowled 12 balls, bats for 8 balls. And so it's not as if he's coming back for a test, but anyway.
I also just wonder how much of it is down to the aura. I mean, he got Ian Bell first ball. And I just wonder how much of that was Ian Bell just feeling slightly perturbed by the sight of seeing Flintoff charging in again. It was a rather odd shot by Ian Bell. He didn't quite connect and got caught. And you think he's still got that. You know, everyone will still look at him with that reverence. But you made the comparison with KP, and whereas Flintoff made a sort of fairly heroic return yesterday, it was another miserable day for KP, and I'm one of many England fans, I guess, who are very sad that I won't see KP again in an England shirt. But when he went off to become a T20 mercenary, I thought there is a silver lining to this. You know, I live up the road from the Oval. I thought it's going to be great to see lots of him playing. But he's actually become a rather cautionary tale that it's not quite as easy as that. He's admitted in recent interviews that he just hasn't played enough cricket this year to keep sharp. You simply cannot just turn up at the IPL for a few games, turn up at the Caribbean League, you know, turn up at the T20 Blast every Friday and expect to look the business. It's been a miserable run of form for him, and we just haven't seen that same old flair. And I mean, yesterday's innings was very typical of it. And I guess what really intrigues me is whether at this stage, with his international future gone, with tons of money in the bank, does he have the hunger to reverse this slump, or actually will he kind of fade away?
And you talk about a cautionary tale as well, and I think that's really important, because actually in an age where we're having increasing questions around whether 2020 cricket can be a kind of self-contained subset of the game that doesn't necessarily need to, you know, cross over into Test or any other limited overs format, you know, this idea that people can be specialist 2020 mm-hmm. players, it's interesting on the back of this. Exactly as you're saying, that is there enough decent cricket and decent top level 2020 to actually sustain someone's career and someone's form?
But you made the exact point with someone like Flintoff. I mean, for him at his stage of his career, it's great that he can turn up and only play that little bit. But I think maybe for a batsman like KP, only having a few balls at the Oval on a Friday, then not playing again for another few days, it really seems to have done for his sharpness. And I do really fear for him, actually.
Mm-hmm. So over here in Sydney, obviously I'm a little bit dislocated time zone wise in terms of the recent test between England and India. And actually, it's made for a really, really rubbish experience, because I love watching Test cricket, and it's very rare that I actually get bored by it, either if it's a kind of, you know, batsman racking up 600 runs or, you know, matches that are all over in 3 days. But there's been a kind of grim inevitability about this series that has just meant that every single morning that I've woken up, rolled over and checked the score on my phone, that it's just been the same situation again and again and again, certainly for the last two tests, which has just been complete Indian capitulation and England kind of dominating. And it, in a sense, I don't really mind that, but there's been none of the kind of sort of changes in momentum back and forth between days that you really characterise as great Test cricket and actually keeps you intrigued for 5 days. It's simply been that there have been mini collapses and moments of brilliance, you know, every now and again, and the Indians just haven't really coped. So, I mean, I suppose that's my moan of the last fortnight. India, you haven't been up to scratch.
It has been miserable as a contest, and it's also left us struggling to really work out how good this new England side is, I think, because India have been so poor. I think the one thing I would say is that things were looking so dire after Lord's that actually England desperately needed to just have a few massive wins, basically. They needed a few thrashes totally. Just for confidence. And they've got that, and you could sense the whole swagger that the team had got back at the Oval from Cook through actually all the rest of the players should hopefully set them up well for the winter.
From the archives. And this episode, Andy's going to tell us about the 37-year-old feud. No, not year old. That makes it sound like a person. Okay. From the archives. And this episode, Andy's going to tell us about the 37-year feud that began in a bar.
It's March 1977, and we are indeed in a bar at the MCG. There's a 21-year-old Englishman. He's already played a couple of ODIs and is playing club cricket in Oz on a scholarship. Many reckon he might be the next big thing, and he's inclined to agree. There's also a 33-year-old Australian present. As captain of his country, he had created an uncompromising team known to many as the Ugly Australians. No one really knows or agrees on exactly what happened next, but we do know how it ended. Ian Botham seems to have heard Ian Chappell insulting the England team. Botham objected, and there was soon a full-scale row. Chappell claims that Botham then put a glass to his throat and warned him that he would cut him from ear to ear. Botham since has strongly denied this, saying, "The day I have to resort to that is the day I know there's something wrong." According to Botham, he then punched Chappell and sent him flying backwards off his chair into a crowd of Aussie rules players. Chappell says Botham only pushed him off his chair and then got hysterically angry. Chappell then says he got up, Botham got up, suggested that they settle it outside. Chappell replied, I don't fight. You either finish up in jail or hospital, and I don't intend visiting either over a like you. Chappell then left the bar, pursued by Botham. Botham says he hurdled the car bonnet to try to get to the Australian. Chappell says Botham was restrained by a fellow teammate.
It's an absolutely brilliant tale, isn't it? Because I suppose it's just like any other bar brawl, essentially. You know, you change the names, or at least you put the names in of just two random people on a Saturday night in Melbourne. And it's just the kind of thing that would happen anywhere. But somehow this kind of slightly grubby, actually not particularly eventful thing has taken on this kind of aura of, you know, this legendary status somehow. What was the reason that it's sort of actually, you know, we're all talking about it now and that we haven't just forgotten about it?
Well, I think a key part of this is, you can see from just going through the story, the two of them are both very proud about, they don't want to give up on their version of it. They're both very sort of stubborn on that in their own way. I think a key point here as well is that this was a rivalry that began in a bar. I think often when you get these like on-field clashes, it's very easy to resolve them, actually. You know, you think cricketing history is full of rivals who went at each other very, very hard on the field but would come off, share a pint afterwards, all fine. But for some reason, the fact that their rivalry started in that environment seems to have made it much, much more poisonous. I guess the other thing you have to look at for length, really, is their personalities. The things that made them successful on the field, I think, have also led this rivalry to run and run. I mean, Botham's arrogance is pretty notorious. He's not a man keen on admitting that he's wrong. Whereas Chappell, on the other hand, the Australian team that he crafted was all about this sort of bloody-minded stubbornness.
And I suppose it's interesting when you look at the kind of Joe Root, David Warner standoff that happened around the last Ashes in a bar as well. That just died down very, very quickly. And as much as anything, I suppose, it was because the media didn't really try to whip that up. Whereas with the Botham, I mean, the kind of legendary status that Botham-Chappell rivalry has developed has as much as anything been due to the media, hasn't it?
But these rivalries are an absolute gift for the media. I mean, it was a great example using Warner and Root, but we also think this summer how every time Jadeja has come out to face Anderson, everyone's used it to whip up interest. And the media have certainly used this. It was interesting that when Botham was awarded a knighthood, who did they instantly go to get a quote from? Ian Chappell. He declared, there are many skeletons dangling in Botham's cupboard, ranging from stories of drug taking to general thuggery, and if he keeps peddling his lies, there's every chance more of these stories will emerge. And the point is that the media have kept stoking the fire. I think a great example as well, Australia's Channel 9 hired Botham to commentate on the 98-99 Ashes alongside Chappell, and it became part of their promotional campaign, having the two next to each other. They actually did commentate, but they, in no attempt, you know, no attempt to socialise or sort of really be civil to each other. And I guess this is just a great example where if they'd addressed this shortly after the event, you imagine this would now be something they'd laugh off. They'd probably be pundit mates who'd have a joke about it. But because it's gone on so well, it's been totally blown out of all proportions. Mm. And it has this kind of poison and hatred underpinning it that
I do.
Really quite
I do wonder as well. I do wonder, though, whether there might be an extent, and I have absolutely no basis for suggesting this, but there might be an extent to which actually Chappell and Botham quite like the fact that this feud has become so sort of defining in a way, because actually, you know, it's the personal manifestation of everything that they stand for in terms of cricket, which is namely trying to beat the Australians or trying to beat the English. So I can imagine that there might be to an extent to which they don't actually particularly mind that this whole thing's grown up.
It's not a terrible thing for either of their reputations. I'd certainly agree with that. I mean, Botham in his career, I think part of the reason he endeared himself to so many fans was his willingness to upset people, whether it was the members at Lords or whether it was Geoffrey Boycott. He was content doing it. And Chappell was exactly the same. I mean, he talked about how he wanted people to hate the Australians. He wanted people to play against them and said, God, I hate these guys. You know, that, so I certainly agree with that. It fits with the personas they were trying to create. The Review, and this episode we've been reading Fibber in the Heat by Miles Jupp. Mr. Jupp, much to his distress, is best known for his role as the hapless inventor Archie in the children's TV series Balamori. He's also Nigel in the sitcom Rev, and a stand-up comedian. And for Fibber in the Heat, he undertook something quite extraordinary, didn't he?
So this is set in 2006, and it comes at, a bit of a crossroads in Jupp's career when he decides, as most of us probably have at some point, that he really just has to be a cricket journalist. And basically, to cut a long story short, and we're not going to give you all the details because you really should go out and read the book, basically he blags his way onto the England tour of India, and the book covers the period when he's touring with the press corps as their travelling with the team during the Indian Test matches. Now, one of the wonderful things about the book is that it really does kind of combine comedy and tragedy in a sense. There are kind of side-splittingly hilarious moments, and then there's also a sort of darker edge to it, I found.
I think what Jupp is undertaking actually fits within quite a well-established tradition of journalism, of trying to con your way into interesting places that you shouldn't be. I really thought of people like Hunter S. Thompson back in the day, who really made their career about getting into these strange places. And whatever you think of Jupp, the chutzpah with which he manages to get himself so far, but you're quite right that it actually takes something of a toll on him. And for all the sort of little funny sequences, he ends up suffering what's close to almost a breakdown, doesn't he, sort of later in the book.
He does. He kind of comes to the realization, I suppose, which is something that's, in a sense, slightly inevitable. He comes to the realization that being a cricket commentator isn't the same as being a fan who's allowed to watch the game end on end. And actually, one of the wonderful things about the book is that there's a completely sort of disarming honesty about everything that Jupp writes. So he writes very honestly about the series where he has this realization. And it's not a particularly, it's a slightly kind of awkward thing to read in a sense. It's very vivid. But he also writes completely honestly about both life in the press box, but also life on tour with the team. There's a wonderful scene towards the end when, at the end of a day's play, when Flintoff has been batting most of the day and then bowling most of the day and being captain, and his son's just been born in England who he hasn't yet seen. And the announcement is made that Flintoff won't be attending the press conference, and all of the press kind of muttered darkly under their breath about why on earth can't he be bothered. And Jupp goes downstairs and he sees Flintoff in the pavilion, and it's actually one of the most powerful pieces of cricket writing I think I've ever read, the description of Flintoff.
There's a wonderful line, there are several wonderful lines, but he says, "Now, though, away from the glare of the sun and the cameras, he had let his shoulders and his guard drop, and he looked almost to be without bones, like a heavy overcoat that had dropped from a hook and then lay on the floor in a formless heap." And it's interesting because much of the book isn't particularly poetic, but there's a lovely description of watching a man who's just broken. I mean, the demands of leading the team, playing, being a father, but I think it's to come back to, I think what was your sort of key point is that he has this brilliant benefit of being the outsider in the press box, and we've all thought, and I know the two of us have talked about, God, wouldn't it be great to be paid to, you know, write about it? But he makes very clear that ultimately this is a job, and he talks about how he's being constantly surrounded by people for whom this was just part of the daily grind, part of a routine to be endured, was having a profoundly depressing impact on me. For him, watching cricket had been a pleasure, it had been a joy. He's now surrounded by people for whom this is their 9-to-5.
There's also quite an interesting observation that, you know, at the beginning of the book, he thinks a lot about what he's going to do when he meets his heroes. You know, when he meets David Gower, when he meets Jonathan Agnew, when he meets all of the other sort of retired players and staff. Going to say to them how he's going to fit in as the sort of the new kid on the block. And then actually towards the end of the book, he kind of realizes that actually he doesn't want to have that kind of relationship with them. There's this wonderful episode when early in the book, Michael Atherton comes up to him and he thinks, oh, brilliant, I'm going to have a conversation with Michael Atherton. And Atherton just asks him for a biro. He gives Atherton a biro, he writes something down, gives the biro back and walks away. And then actually towards the end of the book, he actually says, this is actually one of the best kind of interactions I had with one of the commentators, because actually they maintained their distance, they maintained that kind of that aura of aloofness that is necessary when you're sort of thinking about your heroes. Were there moments that kind of surprised you in terms of his description of the press box of life as a journalist.
If you listen to Test Match Special, I think you get this idea that the press box is this great fun bit of camaraderie. And there's this lovely line where he talks about how working in the press office is akin to working in an open plan office in which everyone is employed by a rival company. And there's quite an unpleasant tension. He actually talks about a journalist who says, oh, so, you know, have you heard what so-and-so is getting paid for their column? Oh, so-and-so has just got a new podcast. He hasn't asked me to be on it. There's this bitterness. There's this fear. That being said, they're overwhelmingly actually pretty friendly to him. I think particularly people like Kevin Howell and Simon Mann come out very well in that they treat him very sort of, they obviously are a bit, they're a bit perturbed as to who exactly he is, but they're actually very polite and very courteous with him because, you know, it is quite awkward for him trying to make his way with this group.
And that's another thing, going back to his honesty, another thing that's quite interesting about him all of these people who we see, you know, doing the Sky commentary or talking on Test Match Special and things like that. And actually, he's quite candid about what these people are actually like. I mean, people like Simon Mann and Kevin Howell. Kevin Howell, I only really know as the person who, you know, phones in the county scores into Test Match Special, which seems to be his. And, you know, he's just a voice on the radio talking about what's happening in the rain break in wherever, at the Rose Bowl. And similarly, Simon Mann, who's a bit of a kind of, didn't want to alienate someone, but he's frontline Test Match Special team. And this, what the insights that you get into them by just socialising with them and spending quite a lot of time with them and living with them effectively are, I think, quite interesting. To the debate. In this episode, we're asking when it's okay to write a player off.
I started thinking about this when I saw the ongoing conversation about whether Sam Robson should hold his spot as opener in the England Test side. And you're struck by the fact there's always this balance between people who are saying, let's change the squad, let's move on, let's try someone new in that position, and people who say, give them a chance, what we need is stability. And I thought what was interesting in the case of Robson is that that time period doesn't necessarily always seem to be constant. So with some players we seem to be much more content to give them a longer stay in the side. It may be because of previous successes that we do that. But then I think once as commentators and fans we've identified what we see as a kind of key technical flaw, we're often quite keen to use that as proof to say, no, they just can't make it at this level. And that's often seen as a benchmark for being like, no, they're not quite there.
But often I think, sometimes it's a technical flaw or it's something that they can or can't do, usually something they can't do, that you then decide kind of makes them fall. But I think in terms of the England setup, there seems to be a sense in which players are written off just because of the kind of players that they are. You know, so to use it from to look at it from the other perspective, Joe Root went through some torrid patches when he first came into the England team, and actually he was just the kind of player that England likes, and therefore they decided that they needed to keep him. But actually, when you were talking just now, it actually made me think about Mark Ramprakash, because Mark Ramprakash is quite an interesting situation, because obviously he came into the England team and he played quite a lot of tests. I can't remember how many it is, but I'm always surprised by how many it is. You know, they kept on trying and trying and trying him. But then actually, I think it was good that England came to the conclusion that actually, no, we're just going to basically write him off as a test player. He's not going to be a test player.
But Ramprakash was this bizarre middle ground in that you're right that they gave him a lot of chances, but they always gave him a chance, dropped him, gave him a chance. I don't know. I wonder if he's not a great example of the worst of both worlds, where him a lot of faith while constantly undermining him as well.
But there was eventually the clarity of basically, you know, there was a stage at which he was basically, I suppose, sacked in a way, permanently dropped. Yeah, yeah. And that then it was just unthinkable for him to come back. You know, there were all those calls for him to come back in the last test of the 2005 Ashes.
Now, what you've described about Joe Root, I think, really strikes a chord. And this is this thing about England selecting the right sort. And I think this is particularly prominent in the England opener debate, because I have a lot of sympathy for Michael Carberry, who got into the side at the worst possible time. You know, he went in a tired, out-of-shape England team to Australia to get hammered by a brilliant bowling attack. And Carberry actually did pretty well. You know, he's the second highest number of runs on the tour, showed a lot of tenacity, even if he didn't go and get big scores. But he came in at that tough time, had a bit of a go at some of the coaches, and suddenly he sort of got moved on his way. And I think maybe this is what we really need to be looking at, that from a selector's point of view, they're much more willing to write you off if you've not shown yourself to have the right sort of personality in their views. And that definitely seems to be able to buy you more time in the side.
And there's also this whole thing around, and I'm kind of buying into the stereotype by putting them in the same bracket, but around two players, Samir Patel and Rob Key, who are both massively talented players and who basically one way or other were written off by the English establishment, certainly in terms of Test cricket. Rob Key, I remember, scored a double century against the West Indies, I think. Yeah. In 2004, possibly. Mm-hmm. And then he was just kind of considered never to be the right kind of person and was written off. Similarly, Samir Patel. In Samir Patel, obviously the weight issues were much more publicly discussed and his fitness issues. I think they called them fitness issues rather than weight issues. I'm just being massively politically incorrect. But there certainly is this kind of sense in which sometimes it's easier to write players off than others. Sometimes players sit in that middle ground and a bit like Rabkash before he was written off, where they're kind of half in, half out. But then there are some players where it seems easier for the establishment to kind of draw a line in the sand and just sort of say, you're not the kind of people we need.
But I suppose what becomes really interesting is the extent to which you give players a chance to change. You know, and I think this is where, for me, I think it becomes a really interesting conversation, because I think someone who's not necessarily as focused or committed as they should be to their cricket, should they be given the opportunity to turn that around? And I think that this is where the debate becomes really confusing, because I think in some cases players seem to be given that opportunity, whereas in other cases we don't give them that chance. And I think maybe you just have to accept that the context of the squad at the time, the composition of the selectors at the time, all lead to that slight unpredictability, you know, whether you're going to be given the chance to turn yourself around or not.
So that was the 61st episode of Reverse Up Radio. We hope you're not going to write us off on the basis of it. Thank you for listening, and we will be back in a couple of weeks' time.